This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio. Today it's a rare treat to have in the studio with me a star of TV and movies, George Takei, Star Trek's Mr. Sulu, George Takei, who came out last fall as working with the Human Rights Campaign to combat the right-wing push against gay marriage. George Takei, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be with you and to discuss this with you, but let me put to what you said about my coming out last year in context. I've been together with my partner, Brad Altman, for 2 decades now, almost 20 years. And we've been out in that sense with our family and friends and with the various activities that we're involved in the community and the civic arena. And we support nonprofits, and we've been, our names have been engraved together in granite on donor walls. So we've been out in that sense. What I had not done is talk to the press, you guys, because you're a whole different ballgame. But last year, our state, the state of California, our California legislature, did an extraordinary thing, an historic thing, a landmark event. They passed the same-sex marriage bill, something that the Massachusetts legislature had not done. It was a judicial process that brought about the legalization of same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. And we were elated. All that was required for that bill to become the law of the state was the autograph of another actor, who also happens to be the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Did you expect him to sign it?
We did, because when he ran for office, he made all these moderate political statements. He's from Hollywood. He's worked with gays and lesbians. He's comfortable with gays and lesbians. Some of his best friends are, you know, those, all those cliches. And many people voted for him on that basis. When he betrayed them and played to the narrowest, most reactionary conservative segment of his base and vetoed that bill, I felt I needed to speak out, and in order for me to do that, my voice needed to be authentic. And so I spoke to the press for the first time, and indeed, it has turned out to be a whole different ballgame.
What was the initial reaction there?
You mean from the public?
Right, from the public or the press?
It was very positive. In fact, it was the demands were overwhelming. Everything, print, radio, television, fan newsletters, the whole spectrum. The most satisfying and I thought comforting part was the overwhelming number of positive, supportive emails. My computer just exploded.
People were grateful.
People were grateful, and there were many different kinds of positive emails. There were those that were saying, right on, that's a good thing that you did. There were Star Trek fans that said, I'm a Star Trek fan, and you've added another dimension to it. There was another group of letters that were very moving. People who were gay, lesbian, or transgender, bisexual, who had not, or the gays and lesbians had not come out, and they shared with me their pain, their sense of isolation, and how someone who's as public and visible and had been on a TV series that's still popular had come out, in quotes, and it gave them great comfort and encouragement. I did get the negatives.
I was going to say, living in America, I know you must not have only gotten positive responses. There must have been some negative. How ugly were the ugliest?
The interesting thing was, they were all anonymous. They could not own up to their statements. The other interesting thing was, their grammar and their language command was incredible. It was, I mean, they were practically illiterate, and the vulgar ones were just despicable. And then there were the Bible thumpers. But they were the small minority, less than 10%. And that was the other revealing thing, that all this political activity that's going on, the attempts at legislation, seems to be coming from that reactionary right extreme.
And yet they had success with it in 2004. They're planning on having success with it in 2006. Do you think it's going to work again?
Well, I think that's because we've been caricatured. We, you know, as an Asian American, I'm aware of how stereotypes can be very destructive. We've been defined by the drag queens, and yes, they exist, you know, but we've been defined as irresponsible, flamboyant, loud, and garish. And I think what we need to do, and what we hadn't really done as aggressively as we should have, is to depict the vast diversity of the GLBT community. We're corporate CEOs. We're school teachers. We're professional athletes. We're policemen. And some of our lives are very boring and quite normal. Beyond that, we're part of the American family. We're sons and daughters, brothers and sisters. We're parents. We're uncles and aunts. We are direct. But because of the heritage we have of suppression and hiding and not being out, we really haven't shared our personal lives. And so part of what my Equality Trek campaign is to share our lives, our normality. I mean, you know, the adversaries come up with campaigns like In Protection of Marriage or In Defense of Marriage. Why are they so defensive and protective? Are their marriages that fragile? And so, you know, you look at the male-female marriages, half of them end up in divorce. There's cheating, there's lying, there's infidelity, there's spousal abuse. That's not marriage. What we're talking about with same-sex marriage is two people who love each other, who take responsibility for each other, who care for each other, and are really married, in fact, if not in law. And if anything, what this is really an affirmation of the core value, the true meaning of marriage. Two people who love each other, who may not necessarily be a man and a woman. That's a true marriage.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking, of course, with Star Trek's George Takei. Talk to me a little bit more about this Equality Trek and how you hooked up with Human Rights Campaign to do it.
Well, shortly after I talked to the press, and then that was picked up by all the various other press, the Human Rights Campaign in Washington became aware of me, and I was contacted by them, and my partner and I were invited to visit their operation in Washington, D.C., and it was impressive. The professionalism and the thought-out strategy that they described to me, and the various kinds of expertise that the Human Rights Campaign had in terms of the political arena, in terms of the public relations arena, in terms of the strategic planning area, and the other department that impressed me was their outreach to the faith-based community, because that's where a lot of the adversarial activities have been coming from. But the large majority of faith-based people are decent, fair-minded people. And we The point was that we should not characterize people of faith as the adversaries of GLBT equality. And what we needed to do was to reach out and share the lives of GLBT people with that decent, fair-minded group. And they had a department where they outreached to that as well. It was very impressive. And so we decided that, yes, we will participate in their program. We became members of their federal club and financially supportive of the operation. And when they asked me to go on a national tour, sharing my gay experience as well as my childhood in U.S. internment camps, and drawing that parallel, I said I'd be more than happy to participate. And we've been on this trek, and I must say it has been both exciting, exhilarating, exhausting, and tremendously fulfilling.
George Takei, talk to me about your childhood, those few years you were in internment camp. Your mother was a U.S. citizen, your father was not. Take me through that period.
My mother was born in Sacramento, California. My father came to San Francisco when he was a child. He was 10 years old. And so he grew up and was educated in San Francisco. He was American in spirit, and he felt he was very much a San Franciscan. He was a passionate San Franciscan, as San Franciscans are. I was born in Los Angeles. My parents met in Los Angeles, and I was born there. So I'm really a second-generation Californian. And we were living... I was 4 years old at the time of Pearl Harbor. I didn't understand what was going on, but I'll never forget that day when U.S. soldiers with bayoneted guns came to our Los Angeles home and ordered us out. And we were taken from our home to the horse stables of a nearby racetrack, Santa Anita Racetrack, where we were housed for about 3 months while the camps were being built. And when construction was completed, we were transported two-thirds of the way across the country, across the southwestern desert to the swamps of Arkansas. And
what was that experience like?
Well, I remember the barbed wire fence. I remember the sentry towers and the machine guns that were pointed at us. I remember the searchlights that followed us when we made the night run to the latrine. But, you know, a child is amazingly adaptable. And what would be abnormal in normal times became my normality. I mean, it became just routine for me to line up 3 times a day at the mess hall and eat in that noisy hall there. It became normal for me to go with my father to bathe in a communal shower. And I went to school in a black tar paper barrack, and our school day began every morning with a Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers right outside my window as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all." And so what I do is I draw that parallel of a nation swept up in wartime hysteria, acting irrationally, and, you know, with no due process. I mean, there were no charges, no trial. We simply looked like the people who bombed Pearl Harbor, and that's why we were incarcerated. And here today, my partner and I feel the same kind of imprisonment.
And I'm sure Muslim Americans and Arab Americans have felt it since 9/11 as well.
Exactly. And you know, our history books have been much too mute on that dark chapter of American history. And because of that, we really haven't learned the lesson of the internment of American citizens of Japanese ancestry during the Second World War. And here we are today repeating it all over again. There are people being, the word today is detained, not interned. They're being detained with no due process. people don't these people don't know what the charges are, why they're being detained simply because they have an Arab name or some association, but there's no charges.
I just read that Halliburton has gotten a federal contract to build internment camps or prepare for the building of internment camps just in case.
Oh, dear.
I mean, that's
we
that's
never
amazing.
Learn, do we?
That's sad, isn't it?
We now, never learn.
You were in Arkansas in one camp and then at Tule Lake, Oregon in another one at the end of the war. And you were there when Hiroshima was bombed. Can you tell me what the reaction was of people in the camps?
Well, you know, for me, as I said, I adjusted, and the horrors of that camp, those camps became normality. For my parents, it was the darkest period of their lives. Can you imagine a young couple with three children, one a baby, my baby sister, to be taken from our homes, losing everything, and initially to be housed in horse stalls. And we didn't get information in the camp. But there were a few people who had shortwave radios. They were verboten. I mean, they were, you know.
So they snuck them in somehow.
They somehow snuck them in. There were people who were photographers before the war who snuck in, and, you know, we weren't allowed to bring in cameras. We weren't supposed to be recording that. But they snuck in lenses wrapped in their underwear, and they constructed cameras to record our lives there. And the people who had shortwave radios were able to glean information from outside. And so we got no word of the bombing of Hiroshima through official channels. It was just this shortwave radio information, and it spread through the camp like wildfire. My maternal grandparents came from Hiroshima, and before the war, they sense the winds of war coming. And so they return to Japan with their youngest child, my mother's youngest sister. And she had gotten married there in Hiroshima and had a baby. And they happened to be, my aunt and my cousin, the baby, were in Hiroshima at the time of the bombing. And they both perished in that Holocaust. My grandparents, incredibly, survived. As a matter of fact, my grandmother lived to 105 years old, came back to live in America.
Did she ever tell you what it was like when it was bombed?
Their house collapsed. And fortunately, they were far enough away from the detonation. And it collapsed in such a way that they were shielded from the radiation. But for my mother, while still incarcerated, she went insane, not knowing. You know, it wasn't official. We weren't supposed to know, but there was this shortwave information. She went insane with anxiety.
That must have been awful.
My father finally told her, for you to have peace, let's just consider them having perished, because, you know, tens of thousands of people were supposed to have died, and you've got to, live your life. We learned much later, after the war, that her parents, my grandparents, had survived, but her sister and her baby had died.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, George Takei, Star Trek's Mr. Sulu. Let's talk about Star Trek for the last 10 minutes we've got.
Yes, most certainly. That comes with the territory.
We're 40 years into the Star Trek phenomenon. Tell me about Gene Roddenberry, who was the producer. What was he like? How did he come to invent such a concept?
He was an extraordinary man, and I consider him a real visionary. He felt that television as a medium was being wasted back in the 60s. I mean, here was this potent, powerful medium of communication, and it was being used just for light entertainment. And he felt that there was so much more that could be done with it to inform an audience, to engage an audience, to inspire an audience. And he wanted to use that medium for all those purposes. But television was also a very conservative medium because it's dependent on advertising. There was a time when you couldn't use the word camel in a negative way because there was a cigarette named Camel. So he had to devise a strategy, a way of selling a project that would contain all those elements to the conservative television people. And so he came up with what he sold as Wagon Train in Space, and they bought that. But
he sold it to you as something much more than that.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. He said Starship Enterprise was a metaphor for Starship Earth, and that the strength of the starship was in its diversity coming together. And obviously the visual diversity was ethnicity and culture. But he saw diversity in a much, much broader way because the 60s was a time of the Cold War. Two great powers threatening each other with nuclear mutual annihilation. The madness of that. And he wanted to also imply that that too we will overcome. And so there was a trusted member of the crew with the name Pavel Chekhov. And he spoke with a Russian accent. He was proud of his Russian heritage. And so it was diversity not only of ethnicity and culture, but of history and ideas and politics. And in a private conversation with them, this was after the show was canceled, we were generally talking, and it was general, about diversity. And he suggested that, yes, he's aware of sexual diversity, but he felt that it was important to keep the show on, and you know, because it was precarious all three seasons that we were on. Our ratings were very low, but he implied that this was something that he wanted to incorporate.
Did he know you were gay at the time?
He did not, and I was not out to him at that time.
I'm speaking with George Takei. He did stress that he was going to have a positive role for you as an Asian American. How did he present that, and what did that mean to you? Were you aware of the significance of that?
Well, he described the character to me. He said that my character would be representative of Asia, and that he had some difficult times coming up with a name for my character because all Asian names are nationally specific.
I was going to say, it's hard to represent Asia since it goes all the way from, you know, Pakistan and in India to South Korea and Japan. That's quite a reach.
And the name Kim is specifically Korean. Wong is Chinese. Tanaka is Japanese. So he was trying to find something that would suggest all of that part of the map. And he found to the west of the Philippines a sea called the Sulu Sea. And he thought, ah, the waters of a sea touch all shores. And so that's how he came up with the name Sulu. And he said that this character would be a full-fledged professional, the brightest guy out of Starfleet Academy, and a very good helmsman, eventually to become the best helmsman of the Starfleet. And he would be a part of this the leadership team of the Enterprise. I was excited because, you know, I'd been playing the stereotype Asian roles.
Right.
I mean, desperately wanted to play that part.
I imagine you did. George Takei, in your autobiography, To the Stars, you write that when you saw this role, you knew it would be reversing a pattern in America's images of Asians, at least the images that Hollywood had put forward. What were some of those images?
Well, Asians were depicted in stereotypes, very one-dimensional stereotypes. We were either the villains, the enemy, the bad guys, or the servant, or the comic buffoon. Those were the two types of roles that we were cast as. And here was this role of Sulu, with no accent, and a part of, you know, the leadership team. It was exciting to even think that I might be playing that part. I desperately wanted that part.
And how important was it for you when Star Trek became a movie then that you ultimately became captain?
Well, Starfleet was described as a meritocracy. And if he was the best helmsman of Starfleet, you know, you would think that there would be some recognition of that in terms of titles. And so we got our advances. I was a commander, but I was still doing the very same work as a lieutenant, there chained to the console of the Enterprise. And so I kept lobbying both Gene and the writing staff people. And suggesting ideas, and one of them being a captaincy for Sulu. Kept on lobbying. It took 25 long years, but finally, with Star Trek VI, I had my command, the Excelsior. It was glorious.
I bet it was. George Takei, tell me what you attribute the continued popularity of Star Trek to.
Well, I think it's because of those ideas that Gene had in the show, the diversity idea, but also to look to the future with confidence in the human capacity for problem solving, for invention, for innovation. And to me, the amazing thing is so much of what was science fiction back then, political fiction today is reality. We have indeed a spacecraft in space called the International Space Station, and we have the diversity of this planet working on that ship, including Americans and Russians working side by side in only 4 decades. So I think, you know, the Imagineers are the ones that set the goal, and the inventors and the technicians see that as a goal to work toward, or the political scientists or the diplomats, and eventually that's arrived at. I think what's important, though, is people like Gene Roddenberry to set that goal, a vision for people to work toward. I absolutely, and I'm proud to be associated with a show like that. And I think Gene was a great man who made an important contribution to our society.
Are there going to be any more Star Trek movies?
You know, I keep getting surprised. I thought when we were canceled, that was it. Never expected that we would come back as a cartoon series and then a movie series. And in September, I start work on an episode that's going to be available at your local computers and laptops. It's going to be webcast.
Oh, there you go. George Takei, thanks so much for being my guest.
Great visiting with you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.